it comes from the future, came in through the Stargate. And it's a bit of an admonition, a bit of a criticism of my work here, and I think I better share it with you. It says, "We, the undersigned, would like to admonish you for not being able to correctly pronounce our worthy names. We are written in the book. Please work on this serious problem before we meet in heaven. Our name tags in heaven will be in Hebrew, by the way. We hope you will learn the language of heaven." If you listen to Pastor Ray Sedman's audio messages on Nehemiah from 1989, you will note that he wisely skipped over most of our names. He also talked 10 times slower and more carefully. You are going 3 times faster than Ray did, and the quality of your work is less than 1/9 of what we saw in Ray's day. For shame. And it's got 70 names signed on this. I am chagrin. Now, when Ray talks on this, when Ray skipped over them, he said you couldn't pronounce these names unless you'd been in cemetery, and I haven't. Not seminary, excuse me. Nehemiah chapter 4. We are going fast. Ray's 1989 messages are what I'm using for notes. This week I just went on our website and listened to these while I was working at home in audio. The audio has all been redigitized. It's fresh and clear. Bill Russ has got it. And if you know how to use audio files on the internet, you can listen to Ray, and it's really great stuff. And full of a great deal more of the practical side of Nehemiah. We met Nehemiah last week, who was the cupbearer of King Artaxerxes. I have a couple of articles on Artaxerxes Plutarch's biography of him, which is interesting, and some notes on the temple if you want this extra credit stuff that isn't on the final exam. Nehemiah was the wine taster, the cupbearer for Artaxerxes, and we meet him when he's about halfway through the 40-year reign of Artaxerxes, and he is a trusted servant, slave, really, of the king. And in 445, his brother, Hanani, comes back from a visit to Jerusalem and reports that the city is still in ruins. Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed it 141 years earlier, and it had never been rebuilt. That means the walls were all down in ruins and rubble, and almost nobody lived there. It wasn't safe to live. And Nehemiah was very much disheartened by the state of affairs, very grieved, and went into long prayer, prayed for about 4 months on and off, and finally approached the king and asked if he might have permission to go take a short leave of absence, take a weekend off, and go over to Jerusalem and see if he can help. Now, a weekend off, of course, wasn't realistic when it's 4 months on foot to travel one way, and in fact, he ends up being gone 12 years, as a matter of fact, on this first trip, probably longer than he originally saw. We found that Artaxerxes received his request favorably, though the king had no reason to do that offhand, except perhaps that the queen mother may have been Esther, may have been sitting in there and may be the influence behind the throne of Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes may have been her son, or this is not far from the time of Esther. So the Jewish influence in Babylon was pretty strong. And we find that Nehemiah heads off to Jerusalem, and the first thing he does is quietly go out by moonlight, all by himself with a couple of trusted friends and a donkey, and walks around the city and reconnoiters this several miles of ruined walls, just to kind of see the lay of the land, the hills and the valleys, and where the city once was, and see what the problem was. He did that without telling anybody that he was doing this. And then after he'd gone around the walls, he called a meeting of all the city officials and all the leading people and said to them essentially, "Let us rebuild the walls. Let's all pitch in and get these walls up around the city." And he faced some immediate slight opposition, but the people got to work building the walls, and we saw how they divided up. Everybody joined in, and Nehemiah was an incredible leader because he organized this community effort with men, women, and children all working together, and people, the effort divided as was most appropriate to the section of wall that you lived near or that you could easily work on or that you had a special interest in, and so the work began rather diligently. And it's very wonderful to see that how quickly the work got started. Now, in chapter 4, we're going to find that anytime anything new from God is going on in your life, or any reconstruction or rebuilding, you can expect opposition from the enemy. Remember, we had earlier the rebuilding of the temple and the starting again of the sacrifices, which met with opposition. This represents the restoration of a life that's all broken down to ruin, the reestablishment of a personal relationship with Jesus, recognition that your body is the temple of God, and that worship is the main function of the human heart, to have a one-on-one relationship with God. That's the picture of the temple. But it's not enough to have a temple. The temple is surrounded by a city. The city needs walls. We'll see why a little bit as we go on here. The city is not safe to live in. All the ancient cities in that day were all walled cities. Gates closed at night with troops stationed around. There were all kinds of marauding bands, foreign armies. If you lived out in the country on a ranch, you're not very vulnerable. Somebody might come and raid your ranch and drive off your cattle steal, plunder, but you could generally go back and rebuild. But the city is a place of commerce and trade and needs protection. Highway patrol in those days, no sheriff's deputies running. The government has to make sure that the city has its integrity. So this city needs walls, as your life needs walls. Walls of separation from the world, walls of protection, and gates, legitimate places of ingress and egress, and control over what goes into your life and what comes out of your life. And you are the temple of God. And I mentioned that there are a couple of books out on that describe the picture of the temple and Jerusalem as the picture of a human body. Because ultimately God lives not in buildings and temples, he lives in people. He lives in his people individually and corporate. Now let's see what the opposition looks like. Chapter 4. It so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall that he was furious and very indignant, and he mocked the Jews. He spoke before his brothers and the army of Samaria, and he said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they complete sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are now burned?" Tobiah, the Ammonite, was beside him, and he said, "Whatever they build, even a fox goes up on it, the fox will break down their wall." They're going to build this little puny wall, and if the fox runs up on the wall, it'll collapse. Ray points out that there's a lot of deja vu in here, because it turns out that this bad guy, Sanballat, is the governor of Samaria. That's the West Bank. He's the Arafat of the day. Arafat lives up in the West Bank. And so he's the opposition that comes from the Samaritan community, the Palestinian community, the people of mixed faith who have a little bit of biblical belief, but mostly pagan belief. And then we have this other man, Tobiah the Ammonite. He's from Jordan over there. And then the third guy, isn't mentioned right here, the third guy's from Gaza. Sanballat, the Horonite, it comes from the Gaza Strip. So these are kind of the bad guys that are getting. Geshen the Arab is in here. We'll see that the opposition is gaining momentum as it develops. The first attack on the Word of God is mockery and criticism and ridicule. And that's always hard for us to deal with as individuals. This can come in the form of attacks from people in the world. It can come from those inner little voices of accusation, those little voices inside that say, "You're no good. Nah, drop this project. You got better things to do. God's forgiven you one time too many. Why don't you quit now while you're ahead? Oh, this is never going to amount to anything, this puny little effort of yours. Why don't you just quit right now?" That kind of ridicule is the first way the enemy tries to stop the work of God. And you've all experienced, and you will experience it if you decide you want a closer walk with God and you want to grow and be used by Him. It's inevitable. I don't like it. I thought about this chapter last week as I was leaving here, and I thought, what's going to happen to me this week? Is anything going to go wrong this week? Well, yes, everything went wrong this week. And I'm still alive. And we'll see how God's people handle these kind of attacks. The first one would be mocking and ridicule and criticism from people who are enemies of God. That's not unusual in our society today at all. If you take a Christian stand against abortion or sexual morality or marriage or creation or any kind of an issue which unbelievers do not understand and don't like, you're going to certainly get in trouble with the office or with your neighbors or wherever. Just simply because you're moving ahead by faith, okay? And this, the devil does not play fair. I don't know if you've noticed that yet. He does not play by fair rules. He's not going to have an agreed set of protocols here for how he's going to attack. He's going to look for any weak spot in your life, any place where you're vulnerable, and he's going to go right for that if he can knock you out of commission. It applies to individuals, applies to a church, to a whole church. People of God, we're in a hostile world, and we're God's little remnant, and we've got this quality up there. How does Nehemiah answer this first attack of ridicule on the evening news and in the Jerusalem Post and nasty emails running around the country and all this gossip around town that's been stirred up by these people? Well, here's Nehemiah verse 4. Hear, O our God, we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. That's not a nice prayer. That's kind of sap of God. Nuke them. Get them. This isn't be merciful to them, Lord, and help them because they don't understand. These people are dead set against the work of God, and they're not going to be nice. So you just say, Lord, shut them up, please. Turn their reproach on their heads. Give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquities, and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you. They have provoked you to anger before the builders. Lord, they're not against us, they're against you. It's your work they're opposing. We know, we have plenty of reason to believe that you've called us to this work. And so this work is your work, so it's up to you to defend your work against these, your enemies. All right, that did it. That prayer was effective, and the work resumed. So we built the wall. And the entire wall was joined together up to half its height. The people had a mind to work. Very important to have good teamwork. Very important that all this fear be dealt with, and God restores the confidence of people. That generally happens when you get a personal attack in your life. You notice that? You get depressed, you get down, you get discouraged, and you go to the Lord and pour out your heart, and lo and behold, I find that He generally shows up and encourages you. Maybe you need a little correction, or maybe you need a little gut, but isn't that how you handle it? Pray as boldly as you need to get the help you need so you can get back to do what God's called you to do. Because it's His work.
Does God want us to curse our enemies? How come David and also...
Well, he isn't cursing his enemies. He's asking God to deal with them. These are like the imprecatory prayers that you see in the Psalms in which David says he calls down fire from heaven on his enemies. It's like that. It's pretty strong. So these are not nice people, these enemies. They know perfectly well who God is, and they're opposed to having God do anything.
Would we, recognizing that we're really in a spiritual battle now, be praying more against that than people?
Now, yes, in our day, we recognize from the New Testament that people are not our enemy, that the opposition is in the heavenly places. It's the principalities and powers, the angelic powers are the sources of this evil, and it may come through human beings, but people are not our enemy. There's that major difference. We have a lot more insight into spiritual warfare than Nehemiah had. You know, we don't have to get into, we don't have to break up into factions and go after our neighbors. Okay? All right, now, verse 7. Now, do you think the enemy's going to give up and go away? No, he's furious. It happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, earlier there was only one Arab, now they got a whole bunch of Arabs together, the descendants of Ishmael, long-term, deep-rooted hostility, Ishmael, still going on today in the Middle East. It happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, and the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites, that's Gaza, heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry. Isn't that interesting that God is building a wall and a city, which would be a blessing to all mankind, and be the seat of his government, and people become very, very angry, don't want God meddling in what they think is their world. And in Israel, which God originally had a magnificent temple there, which God gave to Abraham a long time ago, they've forgotten all that history, don't care about history, very angry. All of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Say, the Middle East today is totally chaos and confusion, and this is working. Also, you notice that people who ordinarily wouldn't get along well with each other can come together if they've got a cause against the Jews. And that's what happens when you get these Middle East summit conferences of various powers, European powers, Arab powers. Anybody that has any reason to hate the Jews or hate the cause of God can come together. People that ordinarily don't like each other at all will come together if they can find this way to destroy Israel, drive them into the sea. And that's certainly true when attacks come against the people of God. They come from all sorts of directions. And the aim is to create confusion. That's always a good sign of the enemy at work, when he confuses, divides, fragments the work of God, pits us against each other, breaks down the unity of the body. Confusion. Babylon, the word Babylon is close to the Hebrew word Balal, which means confusion. So you can think of Babylon as the seat of religious confusion. It's the place where you've got every religion under the sun and total confusion and no one clear path. So, all right, verse 9. Nevertheless, second opposition is answered. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. Now, we're not only going to pray to God, and we're going to pray to God as a community, we're going to take practical safeguards, practical protection in whatever form is necessary to make sure that we are not physically attacked. You might even be physically attacked in this. So he's not naive about the nature of this opposition. So he sets guards against, a watch against, somebody is alert around the city now, night and day. Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing, and there's so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall. And our adversaries said, they will neither know nor see anything until we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. People from the tribe of Judah are very, very apprehensive that Judah is the area where they live pretty much, and Jerusalem is where they once lived, and they are genuinely concerned about their families and their children. And verse 12, so it was when the Jews who dwelt near came, they told us 10 times over, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. This little jingle. In other words, the gossip and the rumors running around have got the Jewish, the people of Judah very, very anxious and concerned. And the anxiety didn't go away. So the prayer and the setting of the watch guard hasn't quite solved the problem so that the people can go back to work on the wall. How do you deal with that? Next level of intense, unrelenting opposition from the enemy. What do? Nehemiah is very practical. Verse 13. Therefore I positioned men behind the lowest parts of the wall at the openings. The wall's been built generally halfway high, so it's got some level of protection. But there are open gates. The gates haven't been set, and so Nehemiah recruits a number of the men with spears and shields to go around to the vulnerable spots of the wall and protect it. We do that with one another, too, when we are working together. We help one another in the areas of our weakness and strengthen one another and take care of one another. So Nehemiah is watching for the integrity of the whole city. I positioned men behind the lowest part of the wall at the openings. I sent the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. That would be neighborhood by neighborhood. Neighborhood watch sort of thing. You watch after this chunk of wall because you live right here. You be alert for anything that threatens your part of the wall. That's a good way to handle it. I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the leaders and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Look what's at stake here, the integrity of all of God's people. Here, it's interesting that here in Nehemiah, we're looking at this little glimpse into history of maybe maximum 100,000 people rebuilding Jerusalem, and all this meticulous details in the Bible, and not a word is said about what's going on out in the pagan world. Not a word. All the things that secular history would think were really, really important are eclipsed. This is evidently the most important thing going on the earth at the time. Which is interesting. God's puny little wall building program in Jerusalem is the real news. That's, you know, we never really see what God's doing very well, do we? Especially if you take what the evening news says, you won't find anything about what God's doing. Except more opposition. Okay. Do not be afraid for them, and this could be, you've got it, this now is so dangerous you're going to have to maybe fight for the protection of your own families. The violence and the terrorism is very serious. It happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their counsel to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So pretty soon the enemy unity is all broken down and they're furious that their plan hasn't succeeded, and will they quit? No, but they got to go back and regroup, and meanwhile the wall building can go forward. Verse 16, so it was, from that time on, half of my servants, Nehemiah says, worked at construction, and the other half held their spears, shields, bows, and armor, and the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Leaders were behind the house of Judah. So you do two things. You divide half of your work into building the wall, the other half into making sure it's protected and safe. Not only just for you, but for your for the whole city, then for women and children, and the old and the infirm. And so that's division of labor. That would be equivalent to our putting a lot of prayer and a lot of support around the work of God in the community, and thinking of this battle as a the spear in one hand and the trowel in the other hand kind of a thing. Maybe you've seen that imagery before. And here it is. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built. Not only that, if you're working on the wall, take your sword with you. Just in case. Back up. And we hope you won't be interrupted as you build your section of the wall, mortar wall, rocks and cement, mostly. And then we're going to have some alarm system here. Each one of the builders was all along the wall. The one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. So Nehemiah has a signal man. Nehemiah is watching the activity and participating in the activity from a central location. And he has a trumpet, a shofar man right there so he can blow an alarm and alert everybody all along the wall. And he's also got other watchmen around the walls that will blow the trumpet if there's a threat to that part of the wall. Pretty neat kind of strategy here. I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we're separated far from one another on the wall. Big distances. We're talking several miles of wall being built by some maybe hundreds of workers. And so that workers might be spread out fairly thin along the wall, they might not be able to see the next group working down the road a little bit. Therefore, whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So if there is a crisis and an attack of the enemy, one part of the wall, let's rush our defenses down there. This is serious warfare. And God will fight for us. Battle is not ours. We labored in the work, and half of the people held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. So we got night watchmen, and we've got day watchmen. We're watching day and night. At the same time, I also said, let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day. So this is 24/7 now. So neither I, my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. In other words, we didn't have time to go home and change our clothes, have a shower very often. We had to kind of eat on the run. This project, by the way, is only going to run 52 days, so it isn't like you're in this for long, long months. They get this whole wall done in 52 days. But there is this constant diligence, and Nehemiah is working with them. He's not the kind of a supervisor that stands off and yells orders. He jumps in and works on his part of the wall, too. Now, that's so the enemy's gone away now? No. chapter 5. There was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brothers. Now the next attack is an internal attack. From within the community, the devil loves to do that, to divide the believing community from within. And the problem happens to be that with the labor force tied up building the walls, the regular agricultural harvest and all the commerce of the city has ground to a halt, and so they're running out of food and supplies, and so you're running out of money. So what happens if you run out of food? Well, you go borrow some food from your neighbors, and you borrow and pay interest. We are sons, and our daughters are many. Therefore, let us get grain for them that we may eat and live. There are also some who said, we have mortgaged our lands and our vineyards and our houses that we might buy grain because of the famine. There were also those who said, we borrowed money to pay the king's taxes on our lands and vineyards. They had the IRS and they had to pay tax to Artaxerxes. So all of the daily economy now is kind of all messed up because everybody's building the wall. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers. That is, we're all fellow Jews in a community together. Our children are as their children. We are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. Some of our daughters are brought into slavery already. In those days, if you ran out of money, you could sell one of your sons or daughters into slavery to maybe your neighbor. And that would help help pay for your indebtedness to them, the food that you got from them. That's not cool. And we don't have the power to get our children back when we sell them as slaves. And Nehemiah, when he hears this news, says, I became very angry when I heard their outcry and their words. And he says, after serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and rulers, and I said to each of them, each of you is exacting usury from his brother. So I called a great assembly against them. What is usury?
Interest.
In today's world, we usually think of it as excess interest. And what about the law of Moses?
You shouldn't charge your brother usury.
It is forbidden for Jews to loan money to fellow Jews at interest. It is not forbidden for you to have financial dealings with pagans with interest involved. But this now is a matter of the integrity of our community. And so we don't do this. We don't make money off of the problems of our neighbors, our fellow Jews, right? So no wonder Nehemiah is anxious. And we'll find out a little bit more about Nehemiah right here. He calls the great assembly and he says, according to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. So Nehemiah says, oh, by the way, when I came here, I was originally a slave and I had some money. And so I bought some Jewish slaves back in Babylon. I brought them with me and I emancipated them so they could be free. So, which is the right thing to do. So how come you guys aren't living like that here in Jerusalem? So Nehemiah's example is he's deliberately freed as many slaves as he could possibly get. That would mean Jewish slaves, and restored them to citizenship in the country and put them on their own. So shouldn't the rest of the country live on that same kind of response to the law of Moses? Now indeed, will you sell even your own brothers, or should they be sold to us? And he says, if you want to sell your sons and daughters, sell them to me and I'll liberate them. He's almost saying that. Well, then they were silenced and found nothing to say. So the example of Nehemiah in his life always stands out pretty clear. This guy's godly and he's got character and he's thoroughly righteous through and through. I said, what you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? If the enemies can find that you're not living according to the law of Moses, they'll ridicule you further. I also, with my brothers and my servants, am lending them money and grain. Let's stop this usury. He's been paying money out of his own pocket whenever he can to supply extra food. We'll see. He says, restore now to them, even this day. Stop paying this interest, which amounts to 1%, about 12% a year, I think, is the rate here. Restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, the hundredth part of the money and the grain at 1% per month, the new wine and the oil that you've charged them. So stop this charging interest and mortgaging and making a profit off of the hardship of others in your community, getting rich at the expense of others. They said, the people listen to Nehemiah. We will restore it and require nothing from them. We'll do as you say. Then Nehemiah called the priests and required an oath from them that they would do according to the promise. So he's got a lot of clout. And he's no nonsense about this. In the law of Moses and obeying God. I shook out the fold of my garment. Case closed. So may God shake out each man from his house and his property who does not perform this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied. So you guys, I want you all to pay attention. The congregation said amen and praised the Lord, and the people did according to his promise. This is wonderful about these people who come back from the captivity, the remnant. They are in general responsive to God. They aren't stubborn and hard-hearted like Jews in Jerusalem just before Nebuchadnezzar destroyed it. We've got a healthy community here that hears the truth and generally responds to it under good leadership. It's good. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, oh, we didn't know that. Now we find out that when Artaxerxes sent Nehemiah on this trip to go look over the affairs, in the paperwork was this appointment in which Artaxerxes appoints Nehemiah to be the governor. And now Nehemiah hasn't brought that up yet. He's kind of modest. But he's actually the designated representative of Artaxerxes, so he's the governor of the whole region. He's kind of comes out now. And we'll see that it becomes important a little bit later on. So he has the authority of the king of Persia behind him. And the king of Persia knows that Nehemiah will lack with integrity. And Nehemiah says, now, when I was appointed governor, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, 12 years. Had he been in Jerusalem 12 years? And the whole time I've been in Jerusalem now, which, writing this later, much, much later, I have never lived at the king's expense. Governors ordinarily live rather lavish lives, paid for by the taxes on the people, which the revenue that came in from the people to the king of Persia, which part of it would be used to support the governor in his rich lifestyle. And Nehemiah says, I've never taken advantage of that fat salary and expense account that I would ordinarily be entitled to as the governor on behalf of the king. The former governors who had been here before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Even the servants bore rule over the people, but I did not do this. And as a matter of fact, he has 150 servants. So when he has dinner, when he serves his entourage, he's feeding a big extended all of his officials. And he's got to pay for an awful lot of food out of his own pocket, which he does. Not off of the taxes and not taking advantage of the king's expense account. I will continue the work on the wall. We did not buy any land. All my servants were gathered there for the work. So I had everybody who was in my office as governor pitch in and do the wall, so I made them set aside their own homes and their own plans to get this project done. And there were at my table 150 Jews and rulers besides those who came to us from the nations round about us. And here's the kind of meals that we have to have. Here's our groceries from Safeway or Albertsons or wherever. Now that here's what was prepared daily for me and my staff. One ox, six sheep, fowl, every 10 days an abundance of all kinds of wine. So I have a lot of heavy expense out of my own pocket, and I don't know where he got all this money from because he was only a slave in the king's palace. He had a small salary. But he had, obviously, friends and supporters, but he's gladly supporting his office. Remember me, O God, for good, according to all that I've done for this people. It sounds a little like he's bragging. I don't think he is here. It's just, remember me, Lord, I'm trying my best to do things your way. And going, I want to go overboard to make sure that I'm honorable and without reproach. So, okay. Now, the enemy now gives up and goes away? Nope. Couple more real nasty things here. Chapter 6. It happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies had heard that I rebuilt the wall and there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not yet hung the doors and the gates. Sanballat and Geshem, meeting up at Arafat's house in Ramallah, said, come, let us meet together in one of the villages in the plain of Ono. but they thought to do me harm. Let's have a summit conference and a peace treaty, an Oslo Accord, and some kind of international. We'll have peace in the Middle East now. What I'd like you to do, Nehemiah, if you'd come on up here to this nice Camp David place up here in Samaria, let's negotiate a peaceful settlement and we won't bother you anymore. Nehemiah knows right away that there's treachery in this plan. And he says, I sent messengers to them, polite reply, I cannot, I'm doing a great work, I cannot come down now. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you? I'm really sorry, I'm busy with more important matters right now. They sent me this message four times. And I answered them in the same manner. You know, sometimes the enemy can pester you enough that you'll just finally give in. Well, he doesn't give in. And he gets the same letter four times. You know, politically, it sounds like he should have gone and had this conference, you know. You get the UN mad at him, and he's got France mad at him, and he's got Europe mad at him, and yet he's getting it all. Now then, Sanballat gets is really irked. And he sends a fifth letter, and this is an unsealed letter. This is the letter that every messenger along the way will open and read and discuss. So this is not a private political letter. And here's what it says. It's in verse 6. We have this record. We have this letter here. It was unsealed and somebody put it on the internet. It is reported among the nations. That's pretty intimidating. It's reported among the nations, and Geshem, the Arab, says, that you and the Jews plan to rebel against Artaxerxes. Therefore, according to these rumors, you're rebuilding the wall that you may be their king. You're on to you, Nehemiah. You really want to be king, and you want to rebel against Artaxerxes, and this is why you're doing this. And it's rumored well around. All of us think that that's your real plan. And you also have appointed prophets to proclaim concerning you at Jerusalem, saying there is a king in Judah. Now these matters will be reported to Artaxerxes. We're going to send a message over to Artaxerxes and tell him that you are going to have a coup and rebel against them.
So it's an open letter to help spread the
rumor. It's an open letter to get this rumor all through the rumor mill, yeah? Get everybody believing this lie. Come, therefore, and let's take counsel together. Now, in view of this widespread rumor, we would like to work together with you, Nehemiah, and let's figure out some kind of an amicable peace treaty here in the Middle East, and we'll all get along. And you just come around out up here to our meeting place. I sent him saying, no such things as you say are being done, but you invent them in your own heart. Now, this is an open public letter, too. And Nehemiah doesn't go through it point by point. He just says, none of this that you say is true. They were all trying to make us afraid, saying their hands will be weakened in the work and it will not be done. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. So if you're doing God's work and you've examined your heart and you've examined what you're doing, go ahead and do it and don't be intimidated by the enemy and just tell the truth, speak the truth in love. And Nehemiah's got the lifestyle, the reputation, the clout, the integrity that he can answer this sort of thing. Recognizes this as an attack from the enemy. Pretty nasty, you know. Not nice. Another attack coming.
It was probably harder to undo rumors.
Oh, yeah. How do you undo rumors in those days when they go by word of mouth and neighbor to neighbor and person to person? How do you undo those? No mass media at all. Afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah. So this crisis is resolved. By just Nehemiah's straightforward answer, these charges are all false, and they go back and finish the walls. And now we get a false prophet comes along here. Another attack from within the community. Afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, son of Mehetabeel, who was a secret informer. He said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for I hear they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they're coming to kill you. This guy, as a false prophet, he says, I had a word from the Lord, a warning. Now God spoke to me, and he told me that the enemy was going to attack you tonight, and you and I need to go hide in the temple, and so you'll be safe from this attack. And I have, this is the Lord gave me this word for you. Whoops. Anything wrong here? Yes? Well, it's Nehemiah says, should such a man as I flee? I don't need to run and hide. Who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Because forbidden but anybody but the priest to go into the temple. So right away he spots this guy as a false prophet. This is not a word from God. There may be some real danger, but this isn't it. And this is exactly the wrong thing for me to do. If I went into the temple of God, everybody would immediately know that I violated the law of Moses. Remember, there was a king who did that. Amaziah, who went into the temple of God and became a leper. Okay. See how far away we are from the kings now? Anyhow, so this is clear. Now you see then that this would appear to be a word from the Lord. But is it consistent with the scriptures? Is it consistent with the rest of the Bible? Or is it spurious? It's spurious, so you ignore it. He says, verse 12, I perceive that God had not sent him at all, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Can you go hire theological opinions these days to support your own agenda? Oh yes, you can go to Bible schools and seminaries and preachers and set up some scholarship funds, and you can do all kinds of damage to the work of God if you wanted to do higher and higher these days. No problem at all. And this is a hired prophet who's hired to destroy the work of God. So that the problems that arise from within the believing community are really insidious because they come in the guise of truth. And we have to test them and discern them and evaluate them and reject those that are genuinely not from God.
Gives a new meaning to higher criticism.
Higher criticism.
Oh.
Very good.
Do we have a rim shot anywhere?
For this reason, verse 13, he was hired, that I should be afraid and act that way and sin, so that they might have an occasion for an evil report that they might reproach me. So the enemy would like to discredit you in the believing community or discredit you with King Artaxerxes or anywhere else, if possible. Attack on character, reputation, doesn't have to be true. My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to their works. Bring the record of these guys out into the public, Lord, which eventually does happen. Bad guys eventually come under God's exposure and judgment. And also, there's another one, the prophetess Noadiah. And the rest of the prophets who would have made me afraid. We don't know who Noadiah was. She was a prophetess, one of those TV late night healing. Put your hands on the radio. Write in it for our prayer handkerchief. She's probably made something like that. And there's false prophets around. Misleading voices. Do we ever need discernment today? And we listen to broadcasters and TV programs and internet websites put up by who knows who. Yes. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month of Elul, August, September. They've worked through the hot summer in 445, in 52 days. It happened when all our enemies heard of it and all the nations around saw these things. They were very disheartened in their own eyes. They perceived that this work was done by our God. Now that's really interesting. That God himself eventually vindicates the work. And God himself puts his stamp of approval on this project and says, look, this is my work, you guys lay off. And scatters them and they have nothing more to say. Work speaks for itself. So God does vindicate his people, but it was, boy, what a struggle it was getting there. This was not easy. So that will happen to us as we walk with the Lord through our lives. Discouragement and defeat and attacks and nasty mean things from within the community and outside the community, and if you want to stand your ground and stay in prayer and call on the Lord and make sure you're doing things His way, and then what you do will stand. So you thought the Christian life was all a bed of roses and you weren't going to get any of this conflict and it was all going to be just all good news all the way. Except I know that you've all had these trials already. Right? Okay, Moreover, in those days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters to Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came to them. Now, we've got more problems with Tobiah, haven't we? Because Tobiah is going to cause long-term problems. Because Tobiah, this Ammonite guy, is going to marry himself into Jewish families where he can get himself into the Jewish community and be thought of as a respectable member of the Jewish community, but he's not. So this is later problems. And we just get, what Tobiah is doing, he's stirring up ongoing trouble still. They reported his good deeds before me and reported my words to him, and Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So this Tobiah is going to be a long-term problem of dissent within the Jewish community. Dissent within the Jewish community is very characteristic of the Jewish community. Yeah, Mark?
It strikes me here, part of this is the book I'm reading too, the alliances that we make in our own thoughts with worldly counsel have a way of coming back and causing us continued grief over time. It isn't just a matter of one single confrontation, but the things that we've told ourselves are true that aren't have a way of just continuing to cause
things that aren't dealt with thoroughly in the first place that come back to haunt you. And this is another one. This is one of these mixed marriages in here that Ezra had dealt with, but that still happened to some degree. And Tobiah had insinuated his way into the people of Israel by marrying into the Jewish families and living on their good reputations. But he's opposed to God all along in his heart.
That's what I was going to say.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I thought Ezra had dealt with that, but...
Not, well, it comes back again. And it comes back again, and we haven't heard the last of this guy, actually. I think we find him again in the...
very end?
Yeah, and we'll run on to him again.
Yeah.
Now, chapter 7. Then it was, when the wall was built, and I had hung the doors, when the gatekeepers, the singers, and the Levites had been appointed. Now the city can begin to function as a city with singing and music and worship and safety and security and business life, and the community can begin to run. I gave charge of Jerusalem to my brother Hananiah. His brother gets to be governor of Jerusalem. Trusted brother, his own flesh and blood brother probably. And Hananiah, the leader of the citadel, that would be the military defense forces, the sheriff's department, the policemen that watch the walls. Now maybe all those old hymns and things in the Old Testament about watchmen on the walls, maybe that all sort of makes a little more sense now. We've got a walled city, and we've got guards, and we've got gates, and now we can live in security within these walls. Wonderful old themes that we still hold today come right out of here. Now, I gave to Hananiah was a faithful man, and he feared God more than many. This military general. I said to them, do not let the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot, and while they stand guard, let them shut the doors and bar them, and appoint guards from among the inhabitants of Jerusalem, one at his watch station and another in front of his house. The city was large and spacious, but the people in it were few, and the houses were not rebuilt. So like most ancient cities, we close the gates at sundown, and we lock the gates, and we put watchmen on the walls all night to guard us from alarms by night. And in the daytime, we have people watching to see who comes and goes in the city, so commerce and trade and business and all the life of the city can flourish during the daytime, and the city can sleep safely at night with watchmen around it guarding it. Do you feel like you have a wall in your life that you go to bed at night and you're safe from evil? Yeah. Do you have these walls in good repair so that you have a sanctuary around your life and you are protected against what comes in and what goes out? Yes. Now, that's the idea. Now, we have, that we still have a major problem. This this list of names that I'm not going to read and get myself in trouble again. This is very much Nehemiah does next is he goes to the temple archives and he gets the record of Ezra from 93 years early when Ezra had recorded the names of the people who came with him in the first wave of immigration and who settled there. And there they are on a scroll under the temple. Probably all kinds of scrolls under the temple in Jerusalem. Somebody ever gets there to open them up. But the Jews keep meticulous records. And here's the list of names of the original families who came to Jerusalem in the first wave, and now we have the problem of we got to get Jerusalem repopulated. Maybe the population is 1,000 or 2,000. It ought to be maybe 100,000 people. How are we going to get people to move back into Jerusalem? Well, let's give first choice to the families of the first immigrants, to those godly people who came early and gave their lives here. Let's give this the first option to people who helped build our country and then come live in our city and repopulate it. Now we've got a big real estate boom. And Jerusalem, it will be safe to live in, so we can build up the population of the city again. The life of the city depends on a functioning temple, and it depends on the wall. And all the rest of the life of the city is not going to run right if the walls are all broken down and the temple isn't functioning. All sort of makes sense? That's essentially, we find that this chapter closes with an expression of something of the generosity of the people. The heads of the father's houses gave to the work. The governor gave to the treasury 1,000 gold drachmas. This governor, that's his brother, sent to the treasury 1,000 gold drachmas, 50 basins, 530 priestly garments, and some of the heads of the father's houses gave to the treasury of the work 20,000 gold drachmas, 2,200 silver minas, and that which the rest of the people gave was 20,000 gold drachmas, 2,000 silver minas, and 67 priestly garments. So the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, and the singers, and some of the people, and the Nepenim, and all Israel dwelt in their cities. It's a free will offering, particularly for the Levites and the temple workers, so that we can have a functioning temple as a central place of worship and teaching. Now we can get on with the teaching of the scriptures. And so the Levites have no other source of income, and so they're supported by the generosity of the people to get them ready. Okay? Now guess what comes next week? Ezra comes back. And we get this marvelous, marvelous section on Ezra's great teaching, and the teaching of the Word of God, now that the city walls are up and the city is safe. Thoughts? Comments? Questions? On this? Yes, ma'am.
Now the continuing, ongoing work of the temple, not the completed work of, you know...
Yes, yes, it seems like the wall. Nobody says who came from the wall. Well, where the money came from the wall. It must have come from... There's plenty of rubble to work with, so you don't have to have rocks hauled in from the quarry or anything. In fact, in Israel, you don't have to have rocks hauled in from anywhere.
The question... Wonder how high they built that wall. They talk about Nineveh had walls that were 300 feet high. You start thinking about 300 feet in Jerusalem, that's the end.
No, I think thick, because I remember the chunk of wall that's been excavated was 10 feet thick or something like that. What, I don't know. I really don't know. If somebody can look that up and tell us next week, I would suppose 8 to 10 foot walls or 12 foot walls.
I read somewhere, I think maybe it was the walls were 22 feet.
22
wide.
Feet.
Wide.
Oh, wide.
Wide.
Wide. Yeah, that's about right for
them. I don't know about the height, but...
I don't think they're...
Well, one thing is that they could drive two chariots.
Now, that's the walls of Babylon. These double walls around Babylon that Nebuchadnezzar built were... you could drive chariots around them. And there was a big moat in between, and they were double walls, and they were big towers, and they were absolutely enormous. So these are modest. This is a modest wall. It's not. It's intended to be your primary protection against a land army or a land invasion. The present walls in Jerusalem, which are Turkish, are not terribly high, about 30 feet or something. Somebody can look that up a little bit. If we know, I don't even should know whether we know or not. Just
yeah, these five letters of protest came just during the 52 days of the building?
Apparently, yeah. Apparently. It seems like an awful lot's happened awfully quick.
Yeah, that's what I was
saying. There's a whole 12 years that's jumped over here, too, you know, because he jumps ahead to let us know that he's been in Jerusalem for 12 years and he's the governor there. So that's kind of added in as an afterthought. But the wall building seems to have been under 2 months.
And wasn't he originally just supposed to go back to build the wall? Or not?
He didn't have to build the wall. Remember what he said to Artaxerxes? He didn't mention Jerusalem by name. He said, the tombs of my fathers are in ruins, and I want to go look after the well-being of my people. And so he had no big agenda. And he wanted to do something about the ruined condition of Jerusalem where his forefathers had lived. And Ezra had gone earlier with the permission of this same king, as you know. And I suppose he got out there, and then he now, Artaxerxes sends a letter telling him to take over and be the governor. Taxes flowing back to Babylon. Fine. And the law and order out there. And so he gets his tour of duty extended for at least 12 years. And I don't know who did the wine tasting in the... Okay. Yes?
You were saying they had a free will offering for the, I guess it was the priests, because that's how they support themselves. I guess I would just encourage ourselves to do an accounting, to do a free will offering. I mean, if we think of our gross income and 10% of it, just to evaluate where our money's going and try to be good stewards of it.
Within the Jewish community, there's an obligation of the people to care for widows and orphans and needy families in your immediate. It was part of the community. That's taken for granted that you do that. Now then, the Levitical priests are served in the temple. We don't have a separate priesthood or clergy in that sense. Now, we do have men and women of God who commit themselves to teaching and building up the body of Christ, Ephesians 4. And those people who serve the rest of the body of Christ can be supported by the people if they want. Paul chose not to be, but that is legitimate. Sets Bible teachers and pastors who are doing their work are set free if somebody enables them to do their work without having to do tent making on the side. It's optional. Now, the tithe was, the 10% tithe was not optional. It was mandatory. It was in the law. Most, you gave 10%, and it went to the temple. Now, if you give money today, you don't have to put it in a central offering, obviously. It'd be nice if you did, but no, otherwise the lights will go out in the building here. But the idea in the New Testament is to give generously and liberally and prayerfully to things that God lays on your heart. That's the New Testament. With the idea that everything you have belongs to God anyway, and you're only the steward over it. But notice how every time there's a success in here, we get that spontaneous upwelling of worship and thanksgiving and generous giving and gratitude to God who's done this work, and you've had a role in it, and you've had a part in it. It's our work together. Next week should be good. You got a lot of notes, right? Grace Edmonds' notes are very helpful with regard to the practical application. I'm glad Mark called that to our attention today, that this is about us. This is not just a chunk of ancient history. Father, thank you for this exciting historical account from 2,500 years ago. We could just go in our mind's eye right back there and see all this work going on and the conflict. It's so much relevance for our own lives, and even for Israel today. These same kind of forces are at work, opposing the work of God. The work of God is certain and will be accomplished no matter what the opposition is. So I pray that you'd help us to see the application to our own lives with regard to the attacks that come to us, of discouragement and character attacks and devious attempts to undermine the things you've given us to do. Help us also to learn to deal with the internal attacks that come to divide and polarize God's people and to set us against one another when you desire the unity of that spirit to be preserved. So I pray that we can learn from this great section in Nehemiah and be alert and watchful. And please, Lord, restore and rebuild the walls in our own lives that have broken down and been ruined. And give us the gates of protection and watchmen on the walls, and we need that more than ever before. And since our warfare is not against flesh and blood, we pray for just an infilling of the Holy Spirit and divine protection over our lives because we serve the great King. And thank you for our great King who is coming and will put the earth back in proper working order in due time. And thank you that we have a part in that. In the name of Jesus.
Amen. Amen.